Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 11th, 2011. Good on you if your company offers 401k retirement benefits, but beware the investment advice that may come along with it.
Basically, employees don't know the difference. Sometimes when they're supposed to be giving you just general advice, they may be guiding you towards their mutual funds.
We'll hear how to protect yourself from that conflict of interest. For those who are already retired and thinking about heading into a senior living environment, how about a hand with the move?
It's often the case that there's not a family member around, so it's sort of like I'm rent-a-daughter.
And what if personal finance all boils down to a paper napkin and a Sharpie?
There's been a tendency for a long time to try and get to the what we refer to as the simplicity on the other side of complexity, where even I can understand a concept.
The artist is a certified financial planner. That and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Here is your double take for the day. Interest rates on credit cards can actually go down. Yeah, you heard me. In fact, Bank of America cut the rates on roughly a million cards last month, and other banks are expected to follow suit. Lucky customers? There's a little more to it than that. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Millions of people saw their interest rates get jacked up and their credit limits slashed during the recession. To try and address that, Congress's CARD Act said if a bank raises someone's interest rate, it has to review that customer's account after 6 months to see if that rate increase was, quote, appropriate. Bill Hardikoff heads consumer credit website LowCards.com.
There are a significant number of people with good credit scores that might have missed a payment or might have been late on a payment one time or two times, and all of a sudden they had their interest rate go up from, say, 12, 13, 14% all the way up to 27, 28%.
Banks keep their calculations under wraps, but Hardikoff says if customers made on-time payments for 6 months and increased their credit score, their interest rate may have been cut in half.
If I were a cardholder, I would not be holding my breath expecting a great decline from my credit card issuer.
Ron Shevlin is a banking products analyst for the Aite Group.
Although a million customers sounds like a lot, the best estimates that I've seen put the total number of credit card customers that Bank of America has at about 60 million. So in effect, about 2% of Bank of America customers saw an interest rate decline.
That means of the more than 170 million credit cards in the U.S., interest rates would get cut on roughly 3 million cards. Shevlin expects only the very best card customers will see their rates drop. And best customer, from a bank's perspective, is someone who doesn't pay off the balance every month, but who does always make a payment and has excellent credit. Still, even that small number of rate cuts is a sign that banks are loosening up, says Ben Woolsey with CreditCards.com. But it's not just because of the CARD Act. That law doesn't actually require banks to lower interest rates, just review them. The reason banks are lowering interest rates, he says, is because they want to hang on to their best customers.
I think they're really having to react to competitive pressures. If they don't lower rates for consumers, they're going to start losing market share.
Aite Group's Ron Shevlin says interest rates are generally set by two factors. One is the broader economy, market interest rates. The second factor is something the customer controls.
It's very much driven by your credit score. And there are bands of credit scores that put you in a certain range.
Shevlin says that even though most people won't see their interest rates go down, credit card regulations have prevented a lot of rate hikes that might have otherwise happened.
Had the CARD Act not been enacted, many more customers would most likely have seen increases in their interest rates on their credit cards.
Shevlin points to one provision of the CARD Act, which prevents issuers from raising the interest rate on a credit card within the first year. That spelled the end of the once wildly popular teaser rate.
Get a new Capital One card and all your purchases are interest-free until May 2001.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
If we've said it once, we've said it a bajillion times. If you have a 401k retirement account at work, use it. But there is a catch. A new report from the Government Accountability Office warns employees to look out for biased investment advice from the companies running the plans. Michelle Singletary wrote about this in her Washington Post column, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So good to be here.
Let's start with an explanation of what we mean when we're talking about the financial advice coming from the company running your 401k. That would be what, Fidelity, Vanguard?
That's exactly right. You know, it's interesting. Lots of people don't realize that there's layers to how their 401k is set up. So essentially, your employer says, I want to offer a 401k to my employees. Then typically they will go and hire a company to run the program. Now that company can contract out or do it themselves to give employees advice. Most of them, what they will do is set up so that you can call and get general advice. And it's really important to understand what that means. So that say you are about to put money into your 401k and you really have no clue what to do, you could call up an 800 number or go online and put in some general information, how old you are, when you expect to retire, and get a model asset allocation rundown. Now, some companies may hire or pay for the company to sit down with you, go over everything that you have to come up with an individualized plan for you.
Well, then what did the GAO find this time?
Well, what they found was that basically employees don't know the difference. Sometimes when they're supposed to be giving you just general advice, they may be guiding you towards their mutual funds because it seems that there's some other deals going on where they get more money if you put money in certain mutual funds.
How does that then affect your potential returns?
Well, you know, the more you pay for your funds, that directly impacts your return. So, you know, you want to try to find funds or advice or whatever that is the least expensive.
And is it possible for the average investor to figure this out on their own?
I'm laughing because the answer is, I mean,
that's a resounding no.
it's sort of a catty no. You know, listen, the fact of the matter is you're going to have to try to figure it out the best way that you can. You know, I generally advise people, if your company has set up a system where you can get some general advice or even individual advice, you should take it because most people don't know where to go. If you're savvy, you can go out and find someone and hire someone yourself. For example, I hire someone that has helped me figure out, you know, my ratios. And it worked out great because it turned out I was far too conservative for my age because, you know, I'm very young.
Well, what really struck me was this line from your column. You wrote, "How many more of these conflict of interest warnings can individual investors take before they just give up?" And you're right. I mean, these warnings come out over and over and over again. And you do have to wonder, I mean, should we give up and not take advice from these companies?
You know, don't give up. The fact of the matter is you have to save whatever you can save. These reports come out and it scares people and they think, oh, what the heck? I'm just, you know, I can't trust anybody. I'm going to put it under my mattress or in a CD. Well, here's the problem. The biggest threat to your retirement is inflation. So if you don't save or invest in a way that at least keeps pace with inflation, what you buy today, you will not be able to buy in the future. So do get advice if it's offered in your employer, but just know that you have to be prudent about what you're being told. Check everything out. If someone says, you know what, you should be in this fund, say, do you get any compensation for telling me that? Are you making any money if I put money into this fund? So as long as you are in the know, you can make a better informed decision. Because the fact of the matter is, financial companies have to make money. Advisors advise you, they get money. But you should know what they get so that you understand whether the information is biased or not biased.
Any responsibility on the part of employers in all this?
Absolutely. I think whenever they're hiring companies, they ought to be clear to the company and to the employees what type of advice that they're getting. Is it the generalized advice? And if that's so, it ought to be just that. They shouldn't be steering people to funds that may pay them more. Increasingly, employers are adding that advice to the offerings for employees, and I think that's a good thing.
Michelle Singletary is the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks so much, Michelle.
You are so welcome.
Friday is the day the money runs out for Uncle Sam. Well, to be exact, the federal government will shut down if Congress doesn't authorize a budget. And what they're really arguing about is you and your tax dollars. And that got commentator Ron Lieber thinking.
The timing of all of this hubbub seems awfully appropriate. It is, after all, the moment when many of us begin adding up our contributions to state and federal coffers. Tax time, in other words. As I began my own tally this year, against this backdrop of political discord, I couldn't help but notice just how many breaks I get. First, a little about me. My household is upper middle class, two incomes, and only one child to spend the money on. But as with many of the breaks in tax land, the more you earn, the bigger the discounts get. That's because you graduate to a higher income tax bracket, so any deductions are worth more to you. And there are a lot of them. The rubdowns for my tricky back come out of a pre-tax healthcare flexible spending account, since they took place at a physical therapist's office. The replacement for the Oakley prescription sunglasses that I just ran over in my car will come out of there, too. My kiddo started learning to swim last summer, courtesy of day camp counselors paid through my pre-tax dependent care account. And let's not forget the big one, five figures in mortgage interest, fully deductible. I don't have a country house, but if I could afford one, I'd get the deduction there too. Amazing, right? I make my living in part by teaching readers how to play this game, so I probably win more often than most people in my income range. Still, something doesn't seem quite right here, namely the fact that with all the things I've just ticked off, there are few, if any, income limits that restrict who can access the tax breaks. Hey, look, it's the law, so I greedily stash money here and there, lapping up the deals that I am eligible for. It would be foolish not to. But if you were to wind me up and march me towards the nearest capital city, I'd arrive with a very simple question for the people who make the laws and write the rules. Why on earth should I qualify for all of this stuff?
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. You can tweet an answer to him at Ron Lieber, or to me at Radio Tess, or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. And we are still looking for your questions about taxes. Go to marketplace.org/money and look for Tax Time.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is our good friend David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hello, David.
Glad to be here.
I wanted to ask you about a headline that I saw in Time magazine this week, and it said, "Whatever happened to overdraft outrage?" And what they're talking about here is the fact that banks have basically come up with all kinds of ways to still make you pay if you overdraft. And my response to that was, well, why shouldn't you have to pay something if you're not tracking your own money well enough?
Well, that's exactly the right question, but there is a fine line. I mean, make no mistake, personal responsibility is important when it comes to money management. I think when it comes to overdraft outrage or whatever we want to call that sort of thing, it's a question of whether the punishment that is meted out is
fits
fair, right? Is it commensurate to the trespass that you have committed? And more often than not, I think the banks get dinged because they come on too strong.
But they are providing you a service. You don't get to park your money for free, right? So if you're not doing a good enough job and you buy something and you don't have enough money in your account, why should they cover it for you without charging you something?
I think the more germane question here is, should they cover it for you without asking you whether you want to be covered? And that was one of the big problems with overdraft protection, was that banks were signing people up automatically for this. And then before you know it, you're getting into trouble. And then they'd also have this very hinky thing whereby they would only pay off the largest thing first,
right,
and
right,
then start allowing the smaller ones to pile up.
They can't do that anymore, though.
They can't do that anymore. Moreover, by federal law, they now have to ask you if you want this sort of protection. That's how this should be.
Yes, but I guess, you know, in this article, they mentioned that and talked about the fact that banks basically have convinced consumers not to opt out of that service. And, oh, bad bank for telling the consumer that they, you know, should have overdraft protection. Well, don't people have free will in this country?
Oh, but I'm going to disagree
with you again,
according
to the Adjustment Bureau, they don't.
But. Yeah, exactly. There's angels on our shoulders. But no, in the case of the banks trying to get people not to opt out of overdraft protection, some of these campaigns were fairly heavy-handed.
But come on, read your own fine print. Your own decision.
And I'd love to say you're right, but let's be realistic. There is so much fine print in the world that nobody can stay on top of it. And look, I'm a fine print guy. I mean, I get paid to read fine print for a living. And
you're
I
just
know
fine,
this.
David.
Well, I know that. Well, I'm fly, is what you mean to say.
Oh, no.
But the simple fact is, no one can stay on top of all this. And so when, say, Elizabeth Warren at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says that all of these sorts of contracts and agreements need to be transparent, they need to be clear, she's exactly right. When you get buried in legalese and get buried in fine print, you're not going to be able to pick your way through that thicket. So the banks need to be really clear up front about, here's what we're offering. And the service has merit, but here's what you are facing as well. Here are the consequences.
But just because they have an ad campaign or some sort of mailer that urges you to go ahead and keep your overdraft protection, I mean, they're within their rights to do that, and you have to make that decision, is what I say.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you to a certain point, but I think the banks just don't play fair, and that's the rap on them. Whether the late fees and the overdraft fees are too high, or whether they are giving you only a slanted world view of whatever they're offering. For example, look at the consequences of making only the minimum payments on your credit cards.
Yes.
The banks have resisted any sort of rule that would spell out what that means for the consumer, how long that would extend your loan, how much interest you'd end up paying up. And when you make it clear, people's eyes open wide and they go, oh, my God, I had no idea.
That's true. It's a scary number to see now.
And that's why the banks don't want you to see it. Again, it's the same sort of thing of transparency. The banks want to inform you. They want to make you a good minder of your money. But up to a point.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that the banks are always the good guys, but I just feel like sometimes we lose the whole notion of personal responsibility in our finances.
And I'll come right back with you on that and say, yes, you are right. Personal responsibility is very important.
Thank you. We'll end it right there. Yes, you are right.
Good night, everybody.
All right, let's take some calls. Stephen is with us from Springfield, Mass. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Very well. Are you thawing out there?
We are thawing out. We're actually now going to flooded basements instead of snow-filled driveways.
Oh, not good. So what do you do there in Springfield?
I do video production. So I'm a producer and editor of videos.
What kind of videos?
I serve a lot of commercial and corporate, you know, for-profit businesses. And then there's the other angel on the other shoulder. I like to do a lot of educational and documentary work.
Hmm.
So I worked for about 20 years in the business. And then for 4 years, I worked in public schools, 2 years teaching television production.
You taught television production in secondary school?
In grade 6 through 12.
That must have been a fun class.
Yeah,
it was very cool. It was great. Kids got their hands to, you know, grab the technology that they love so much and, you know, use it to, you know, tell stories about some of the things that they're doing in school.
Who can't have fun with a video camera?
It's wonderful as a teacher to be in a room where when the bells ring, the kids are like, aww.
Oh, that must be unusual.
It was a good thing.
Well, so you're looking to design a business where you can do both of these?
That's right. I live in Springfield, Massachusetts, and it's kind of one of those former manufacturing cities that's struggling. And I look around our city, and there's a lot of great stuff that's going on. Most of the media seems to cover the bad news, and these great stories go untold. So I'm chasing a bunch of grant and private funding to tell the stories of the arts, the businesses, and the schools that are doing really well.
So have you put together a business plan?
Not really.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm kind of wondering, I guess my main question is, should I have two different businesses?
Because one is nonprofit and one is for-profit?
Yeah.
So I don't know, David. I mean, my first response, probably just because I'm lazy, is that I wouldn't want to have to keep two tax records.
Well, there you
for
go.
For a nonprofit 401c3 and a for-profit corporation.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with that. I think it's a little complicated. And then, you know, just one small codicil to this, and that is, every venture that I've ever seen, whether it was a newspaper or a website, that focuses on good news tends to struggle. And I hate to say it because it seems very cynical to say this, but good news doesn't seem to sell. Like bad news?
Charlie Sheen, anyone?
Cough, cough. Yeah, no kidding. And for every Charlie Sheen thing that attracts inexplicably global attention, think of all the good news stories that fall by the wayside of people who are actually living decent lives and doing good things.
Right.
Because nobody seems to be interested in that. And I guess that's a story for another day. But that's something just to keep in mind, Stephen.
Right.
In your case, though, more to the point, you need to come up with a business plan that's going to get the money you need to do the thing you want. And really, what you need to keep in mind for a good business plan is what the experts will tell you. And that is, first of all, be concise. Put an executive summary in there that'll get right to the point. Then also, you need to talk about the competition that's out there. For example, I don't know what other documentary or video productions are in your state at the moment, but you need to do the market research and you need to be able to tell the money guys why what you're offering is superior to what others are offering. And most importantly, you've got to talk about the business model. And that means basically, where's the money? Because if you're a money guy, you're looking at the back end. And in the case of video and documentary production, you're talking about pretty small margins. And mm-hmm. so you need to be aware of what your distribution deals are going to be, whether you can actually get onto HBO, for example, or Showtime, whether there's any international market. You need to be real clear on all this. It takes a lot of thought and it takes a lot of preparation.
Good deal. I like what I'm hearing, as always, when I tune you guys in. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Stephen. Hey, you know, aren't you right there by the Basketball Hall of Fame?
I am. I worked there for a couple of years when we opened up the new Basketball Hall of Fame.
Oh, how fun. Well, maybe you could do a documentary on that.
Ooh, I like that.
That's one of the things we're working on. It's a great thing, and I definitely, anybody who finds themselves in the 413 area code, make a trip in. It's very cool.
Thanks so much for the call, Stephen.
Thank you. Take care now.
Bye-bye. Well, let's go next to Austin, and he is in San Francisco, California. Hi, Austin.
Good morning.
How are things up there in San Francisco?
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for asking. How are you guys?
Very well, very well. Are you born and bred San Franciscan?
No, originally I'm from Kentucky, from Louisville. Moved out here to the Bay about a year and a half ago. Lived in Berkeley for a while. Now I'm in San Francisco since November.
What was the most dramatic difference that you found?
Probably that most people out here don't own their homes. Most of my friends in Louisville, Kentucky, most of them own their homes. And out here, it's very much a sort of renter's community kind of thing.
Yeah, because I think you have to have, what, $5 or $10 million in the bank to buy in San Francisco.
At least something like that. Then you have to find a place.
Right.
It's so dense out here. That's probably another huge difference.
And not a lot of horses in San Francisco?
Well, you know. No, not at all.
Well, there's some stables in Golden Gate Park. I mean, if you need some equine action,
it's
there.
Buffalo in there too, definitely. Yeah. So, you know, if you need to feel like you're home on the range, you can go out to the park.
Home on the range in San Francisco.
There's bison out there too, Tess.
For me. I mean,
no, it's true. You can go out there. There's bison. There's horses. There's even fly casting pools in Golden Gate Park.
I'll be sure to get there next time I'm up in San Francisco. So how can we help you out today?
So my question is, when I was much younger, my parents, my grandparents, sort of we all operated on this paradigm of if you bought a house, you invested in real estate, it was always like the good investment. You know, and then like I believe the rule was like if you socked up to $12,000 away into some random CD, you'd have $1 million by the time you're 65. So
does that math compute for you, David?
Not so much.
Not so much.
I don't think get my hands on that CD.
No, I'm completely. You know, this is just the stuff that I was hearing when I was growing up. Basically, if you invested in a 401k, IRA, that kind of stuff, compounding interest, they're trying to teach you really early on.
Sure.
You invested a really small amount of money in that. You know, by the time you got to 65, you know, you were going to have a decent amount of money to retire on.
So you're asking whether the rules are any different now.
Well, in Kentucky, what I did was I own my own home. I actually own several homes. How do I essentially mimic home ownership and the savings in home ownership when I don't own a home?
Well, I suppose you'd be looking at any other equity in theory. I mean, you could be looking at the stock market. You could be looking at bonds. Basically, from an investment point of view, investments are investments. And the bottom line is do your homework. Make sure you're investing in something you understand and make sure you know what the exit strategy is should you get there. But that said, home ownership is still a different critter than stocks. I mean, you can flip a stock a lot faster than you can flip a home.
Right.
But you also can't live in a stock.
This is true.
So what I hear you guys saying is just basically, if I'm looking to mimic the savings of a home, of a mortgage, just to basically talk with a financial advisor and look at other options?
Stephen, I think what we're saying is that there is no comparable other investment to buying a house. I mean, it's there are all kinds of different investments out there. You can do stock equities, you can do bonds, but trying to find some sort of equivalent investment to buying a home is it's too different.
Mm-hmm.
So does that help you out?
Yeah, definitely. You guys have been very, very great. Thanks for your whole time.
Thanks so much, Austin.
No worries. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
And finally, David, we have Jeremy from right here in Los Angeles. And I don't know if you will remember this, but Jeremy has been with us before. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. I will remind our listeners that you called us several months ago about making a childhood dream into a reality as you entered your midlife crisis. So let's go to the Wayback Machine and hear what happened a few months ago.
Back when I was 13, I had a poster of this gorgeous Alfa Romeo Spider Veloce on my wall. Well, 2 weeks ago, I turned 38 years old. In preparation of my 40th birthday and my midlife crisis, I want to sock away like maybe $700 a month for the next couple of years to save up for on my 40th birthday to buy like an old convertible two-seater sports car.
So, Jeremy, what did you end up doing?
Well, you know what they say about the best laid plans.
Bye-bye, Alfa Romeo.
Because David really thought that this would be a great idea for you to go ahead and do.
I was so in your corner
And I think I was not in your corner.
Yeah, I think that's right. Tess, you asked some pointed questions about how my wife would feel about that.
Yes.
Well, the best laid plans got changed around for even better plans. A week or two after we spoke, my wife told me that she was pregnant with our first child.
Oh, congratulations.
So we have been continuing to sock away the money, although now it might be for
college tuition?
Yeah, braces. I'm not sure what.
So are you going to be naming your son Alfa or Romeo?
Well, I'm trying to go for both. I just got to get the naming rights from the company. Now, I have a new question for you, if you have a moment. Some other new parent friends of mine have mentioned that they've been getting life insurance, and I haven't done any homework on that.
Hmm.
But it seems like that might be a prudent thing to do.
Good question, and good for you for thinking ahead of time about it.
Absolutely. Remember, insurance is first and foremost peace of mind. As a new dad, and you know, I can tell you because you know I faced this not that long ago, you run these scenarios in your head of, oh my God, what if I get hit by a bus? And what happens then to my wife and child or children or whatever? And at least when I approached that question, I thought there is no way I'm going to leave them exposed to the elements in my absence.
Yeah.
And so I went whole hog. I got a real hefty insurance policy, not just because I knew that this would protect them, because it would, but I sleep better at night knowing that if, God forbid, something happened to me, they're covered, and they are covered for the rest of their lives.
David, is there a rule of thumb if you don't want to go whole hog on what a good amount might be, like 2 times your salary, 5 times your salary?
There are so many criteria you have to look at. For example, if you have a mortgage, you
right.
need to be able to have a life insurance policy that's going to address that, hopefully pay off the mortgage. You need to look at your regular income and whether your spouse has an income or not, and whether he or she also is going to be able to go out and get a job if he or she has to. There are a lot of moving parts to this.
Right. So, Jeremy, does that help out, at least get you started?
That definitely helps out.
All right. Hey, thanks for checking back in with us. When's the baby due?
It's actually, we're a little over 9 months, so...
Oh.
Yeah, so any moment now. In fact, I might have to run.
Oh. Good luck.
If only you had a fast set of wheels.
Exactly. Thank you for your advice.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can email your questions to the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it.
Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Neil Radler, and we are in my favorite Japanese restaurant in all of New Jersey. The first thing you should know, this wallet was a gift from one of my daughters for Father's Day 1 year. A little bit tattered at this point, a little frayed around the edges. It's probably time for a new one. It's got some cash in it. I don't know, $80, $100, about what I normally keep in it. Got the driver's license. Not a pretty picture. This is my grandfather's library card. And the reason I keep this is my grandfather learned to read at a fairly advanced age, in his 60s. I think his wife helped him, but he basically taught himself. And I was always impressed by that. His son, my father, was a lawyer. I myself am a teacher. And so I was always impressed that he was able to put aside his pride and teach himself to read. And it was fun to walk into the library that day and watch him get his library card. So when he passed away, I've kept it since. He was a symbol to me of it not, never being too late to try something new. And I remember thinking about that when I myself changed careers.
You know, he always represented that. He was always, you know, that age to do what he did impressed me. It left a mark on me.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. A couple of weeks ago, we aired a story explaining reverse mortgages. They let senior homeowners borrow against the equity in their houses, and the bill doesn't come due until the homeowner dies or otherwise leaves the property. Well, this week, the AARP filed suit against the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD regulates reverse mortgages. AARP claims a change in government policy is pushing the spouses of some deceased owners out of their homes. Jean Constantine Davis is a senior lawyer at the AARP Foundation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us what has now happened with some of these reverse mortgages.
Well, over the past year or a little more, we've been hearing about a lot of folks who are surviving spouses of a person who took out the reverse mortgage. I think the most typical scenario is where, you know, two people have been married and living in a home for many years, and at some point they decide that they need to access the equity in their home. And a mortgage broker of some kind will convince them that it's better to put the reverse mortgage in one of their names, mm-hmm. or they don't even know that it's only getting put in one of their names. But in fact, that's what happens.
Instead of both of them signing it.
Yes.
Okay.
And the problem with that is that it's not just that the mortgage is only in one of their names. It's that in order for that to happen, the other person's name is taken off the deed to the property. So essentially one spouse is being divested of all of his or her interest in the property, and usually the older spouse is left on the deed and on the reverse mortgage. And the reason that the brokers like that is because you can take out a higher amount if you're older. The amount that you can take out on a reverse mortgage is a function of the value of your property and your age.
All right. So what has happened now is that there was a change in the rules at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Tell us what that did.
The rule has always been with reverse mortgages that neither you nor your heirs will ever owe more than the value of your property. So in 2008, HUD said that's only true if you sell the property. If you want to keep the property, if your heirs want to keep the property, they have to pay off the full mortgage balance. HUD also said that if you want to buy the property from the estate, you have to pay the full mortgage balance rather than the appraised value of the property. This has left, it came, as you can imagine, this rule came at a uniquely bad period of time when values in the housing market had already plummeted, and they have dropped even further since that time.
So now spouses with homes that are underwater are still having to pay back more than what the home is now worth.
Right.
Okay.
And, of course, they can't get financing to do that. So.
Right. How many reverse mortgage holders do you think might be in this position?
That's kind of the $50 million question here. There are statistics on how many reverse mortgages are out there, which I believe is something like 500,000. And a certain number of those are being held by a single, you know, in the name of a single individual. So there's no way of knowing if those people who are individually named on the mortgage are, in fact, single people or if they're married people whose spouse is not named on the mortgage.
All right. Well, I'm sure this will take some time winding its way through the legal system. But meantime, thank you for joining us. Jean Constantine Davis is a senior lawyer at the AARP Foundation. Thanks again.
Thanks, Tess.
For aging boomers who decide it's time to move into a senior living community, the moving business is booming. And it's specialized enough that it has a name. Last year, 50,000 families hired a certified senior mover. Susan Shepherd has our story from Boston.
It would appear from the cars jockeying for space in this quiet Cambridge neighborhood that Carl Crumpy is having a party. But the people dropping in aren't here to socialize. They've come to give him a price for his sizable book collection.
Oh. Helen is the book dealer. Is your colleague with you?
He's coming. I think he's finding a place to park.
Okay.
Crumpy, a Greek and Latin scholar, is getting ready to sell this place. He'll move into a much smaller space in a senior living community.
There's a lot of books in here.
There are a lot. I can't tell you how many.
We will. I'll tell you how many.
To help him organize the move, Crumpy's hired Karen Zweig, a.k.a. the Move Maven. She's what you call a senior mover. For a price, usually in the thousands of dollars, she helps make decisions. She helps clear the clutter.
I call it possession paralysis because people, even though they may want to move and know they should move, they become paralyzed looking at everything in their house and they cannot imagine how they could possibly manage to get rid of it all.
Crumpy's kids don't want 5,000 books, and it turns out most children don't want a lot of their parents' things.
I have six children, and so they're off and on about their eagerness about taking anything off there.
And that's where senior movers step in.
It's often the case that there's not a family member around, so it's sort of like I'm rent-a-daughter.
Part of her job is to bring in help when the kids aren't around. But Zweig says once the decision is made...
Surprisingly, many people are really ready to let go, and I guess they realize that it's just stuff.
Enter Deborah Davidson, the eBay reseller.
Oh, hi, hello. Deborah.
Crumpy shows Davidson around the house so she can find things she'd like to try to sell, like this 1970s Fisher-Price Little People merry-go-round. If it gets snapped up, she takes 30%, and the rest goes to Crumpy.
There's one little broken part over here, but I think it's still very saleable.
It's filthy dirty.
Doesn't matter. I'll clean it.
Getting rid of things, wanted and unwanted, is only part of a senior mover's job. Falwell says it's also about overcoming emotional ties.
One of our early clients said to us, what you really are is psychologists with boxes, and in fact, that's what it feels like we often are.
Grandma's precious knickknacks might not be... as cherished by you. But Zweig says youngsters should make a token gesture to show they care.
I often kind of whisper in the ears of the younger generation to ask for some small item out of grandma's belongings and let grandma know that you really want something to remember her by.
The move is a process that takes the family from the day they make the decision to the moment they settle into their new home.
When I'm moving someone, I try to take pictures of their former home and recreate it. If they have a lot of knickknacks on their dresser top, I'll unpack and put things back exactly the way they were so that when they walk in, it looks and feels like home.
Karen is about the nicest thing that's happened to me in the last 100 years.
Selma Gordon is a tiny, talkative 87-year-old. She had no children to help her move from the apartment she lived in for almost her entire life.
Moving became a wrenching experience.
So when it came time to relocate into an assisted living facility nearby, Gordon turned to the Move Maven, who mapped out every detail, down to doll-sized cardboard cutouts.
She measures every piece of furniture where you're living, and then she'll cut out a piece of furniture like this.
So when her client moves in... Everything's in place.
Without Karen, I couldn't have done it. There would be no way. With Karen, you know, when I walked in here at the end of the day, I could say I was home.
In Boston, I'm Sue Shepherd for Marketplace Money.
We reported at the top of the show on how banks are cutting interest rates for their best credit customers. But for most of the population, credit is still hard to come by, especially the millions of immigrants who may not even have a credit history. A 5-year-old company here in California is growing fast by offering loans to low-income Latinos. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, these loans come with a hefty price tag.
Alex Erdondo is in line with a couple dozen others on a Tuesday afternoon at Progreso Financiero, a loan office inside a busy supermarket near Los Angeles.
Taking out a second loan right now, trying to get some extra things paid off, you know, so.
Arredondo's first loan for about $700 helped him cover car payments when his income was low. He paid off that loan in just a few months. long before it was due.
They were able to help me out, so, you know, I made sure to repay them, but, you know, by, you know, paying it off quickly as possible.
Paying it off quickly also saved on interest. Progresso's typical rates amount to 36% a year. That's more than twice the rate of some credit cards. Progresso's founder James Gutierrez says he provides loans to high-risk borrowers. Many are new immigrants and don't have credit histories. Those who do tend to have low credit ratings or FICO scores.
There's no other access. If you have a 540 FICO score in the U.S. or you don't have credit, good luck ever being approved by a bank. So where do you go?
Often, they go to payday lenders who charge around 400% annual interest and are willing to lend to just about anyone. Progresso isn't so quick with its money. The company analyzes its clients' pay stubs and financial info and checks references, all to determine the people most likely to pay back their debts.
This is like basically a mortgage application for $1,000.
Gutierrez says Progresso doesn't check for immigration status, which makes it very popular among undocumented immigrants. It also helps borrowers build their credit. After a few loans, people often qualify for better interest rates offered by banks or credit unions. But many continue to borrow from Progresso. Janice Bowdler of the National Council of La Raza says that can hurt them.
Your credit score will actually peak and then start to go down. So there is actually a sweet spot for a consumer where you want to graduate them at the point where their credit score is high, but not keep them on this type of credit forever.
And she says it's important for borrowers to compare loans in the marketplace before they take out money. San Francisco resident Lorena Casada says about a year ago, she was barely paying the bills. Her husband was battling cancer, she had a daughter in diapers, and her parents had foreclosed on their house.
Everything just kind of piled up, and I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do?
A friend suggested Progresso. When Casada stopped by the office, she says the Progresso staff asked about her family's finances.
The first thing they do is offer me, well, why doesn't your whole family come and then you can get more money?
Around $5,000 altogether. Quesada considered it, but opted for just one loan at $1,600. Progresso Financiero has made more than 100,000 loans in the 5 years it's been in business. Jose Quinones runs a nonprofit peer lending circle. He says he's concerned about the company's aggressive sales.
For Progresso Financiero, when they're, you know, overly targeting the immigrant community with just loan products, it's going to increase our indebtedness so that it's going to be, you know, even more impossible to get out of poverty.
Not long after Casada got the loan from Progresso, she stopped by a credit union to talk to a banker about taking care of her other debts.
The rate that he gave me was, I think it was 9% interest. With the same credit. And then I felt like a big fool.
Because as it turns out, even with her poor credit, she could have gotten a better deal if she researched her options first. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
For more on poverty and debt, go to marketplace.org/money and check out our Making Money blog. When commentator Webb Brewer was head of legal services in Memphis, he saw firsthand the high price of predatory lending. Yes, personal finance can be complex. Investments, accounts, spending and saving priorities. But sometimes, you know, it's just common sense concepts. So simple, all you really need is a bar napkin and a Sharpie to convey them. Well, it is just that simple for Carl Richards. If you're a fan of the New York Times Bucks blog, you know his work. He'll take an economic term or idea and draw a simple picture that captures it. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tess.
So these drawings are really some of my favorite ways to get at the behavioral concepts in finance. The best part about it is that you take these very complicated issues and boil them down to a napkin drawing. Is this how you kind of tend to think of things anyway?
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's been a tendency for a long time to try and get to the what we refer to as the simplicity on the other side of complexity, right? Just trying to get to the point where even I can understand a concept.
Yeah,
was the goal.
Well, art on the radio is always a challenge, but let's go ahead and see if we can describe one of these napkins. And the one that I've picked out, you have a square and a circle, and you talk about my view of money and your view of money.
That was interesting. Most of these are generated by conversations I've had with people.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to capture this idea of two people not seeing eye to eye, this idea that we all bring different perspectives and views to our conversations about money.
Mm-hmm.
And that day I was trying to capture two people not seeing eye to eye, and I don't know how to draw. So I couldn't draw two people. So I was trying to capture somehow, like, my view of money is different from your view of money. We need to remember that.
So you say that these drawings are based on actual conversations that you have or hear. What was this one?
This one was probably most of the conversations around money, the series we've been doing, has been based on conversations with my wife, believe it or not. So it was probably one of those days where I was like, gosh, it's so interesting that after 15 years of marriage and this being my profession, that we still don't see eye to eye. And we have to take this time to pause and say, hey, is this what you meant?
So we have this square and we have this circle. And so we have two different views of money. What was your point behind that? I mean, it's obvious that we all have different views on money. So again, how are we supposed to square this peg?
The point behind that entire series has been, often we have these conversations around money instead of talking about it specifically. I don't know when this started, but money, politics, and sex, I guess, were the things that you didn't talk about in polite company. At least my generation. So we've never really been given the tools to discuss money in a healthy way. And that certainly hasn't been good. Money is one of the number one causes of divorce. Certainly one of the number one causes of heated discussions in my family.
Then how do you approach that subject with a spouse or with a long-term partner? I mean, if it is one of those verboten things where we try to talk around it all the time, how do you get to the point where you can be direct?
I think it's actually deciding to stop for a second and have a conversation just about that. If you are repeatedly, and this is sort of what happened to me the last year or so, is I realized we were repeatedly having the same dysfunctional conversation over and over and over for the last 10 years, right? And I'm not smart enough to recognize it until it's been 10 years, but I finally said, wait a second, why are we having the same discussion again?
And you're a certified financial planner.
Amen, right? I mean, that's like, it's not necessarily the cobbler that's got holes in his shoes, but we all bring this baggage. And, you know, we've talked about whether it breaks on gender lines or whether it's based on education or your upbringing or your family. And it really, in the end, it doesn't matter. What matters is we're all bringing this different set of glasses.
We will have a photo of this napkin drawing on our website. It's marketplace.org. And we're going to be visiting with Carl with more drawings and some explanation of the gap in behavior that we find among all of us trying to manage our money. Carl, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
And in addition to the drawing, we do have a link to his Behavior Gap blog at marketplace.org/money. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook. And for some great links to personal finance stories, follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, Susie Orman says the American dream is dead.
You know, the old American dream was based on bigger, better, more. That would have been an okay dream if we had the money to have paid for those things.
We'll hear what she thinks it should be replaced with. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.